every system of oppression and power thrives when we do not. And they thrive by stripping us of our humanity, of our capacity for joy and meaning and connection and belonging. And so when we access joy, we are in our body liberating ourselves, and it's the deepest form of justice we can have.
Hello, hello, Brave Table fam. Welcome to another episode of The Brave Table. I'm your host, Dr. Neetha, and this is your oasis, your destination to be all things just a little bit more brave. And now, if you are tuning in, I have an ultra special episode for you. But first, I have a question. Do you believe that accessing joy is your birthright? Do you believe that you have all the power to access it within you right now? Well, maybe you will after listening to this episode, where I bring the incredible Dr. Thanmeet Sethi, who is the author of Joy is My Justice, Reclaiming What is Yours. Because in fact, joy is our birthright. And honestly, after Isla was born, I had faced my own challenges as a new mom while writing my own book. And now I met Thanmeet, where not only is she a current practicing physician and a mother of three, and she was still able to write and publish her greatest work, and which is the legacy that we are bringing her on today for The Brave Table. Now, this conversation is honestly the best of both worlds. We get into practical tools that we can actually reset our nervous system when things are going haywire. We also talk about some of the reasons why we can think joy is not in our wheelhouse, especially when things are going awry in our worlds. And together we unpack this idea that joy isn't just a feel-good emotion. It literally is a potent form of justice. In this episode, she reveals some of the complexities in raising her three children, but not only that, being a caretaker to her child with chronic disease and how she's been able to tap into her inner strength. And we talk about some of the modalities of alternative therapy when we can actually access our vagus nerve in order to regulate and calm our nervous system, and how that can translate to feelings of safety, motivation, and you guessed it, joy. Also, practical every single day tips that you guys can use in your life, in your relationships, including movement, and other practices that get you in a state of calm, but also having joy in your access point. Okay, you're going to love her. She is bringing so much wisdom to The Brave Table. And let me just tell you a little bit more about Dr. Thanmeet. She is not only an integrative, but psychedelic medicine physician, TEDx speaker, activist, and author of Joy is My Justice. She has dedicated her year-long career to caring for the most marginalized patients in the Seattle's refugee, uninsured, and homeless populations. She is also an advocate for health concerns of global communities around the world. Now, there's so much to unpack in this episode. So without further ado, let's bring on Dr. Thanmeet Sethi to The Brave Table. Emotions high this time of year? I know that some of you have been feeling the weight of your emotions. And if you've been told you're too much, or you're too emotional, or maybe feeling that you're an empath and you don't have a place for your emotions to live, I invite you to this Embrace Your Emotions 90-minute workshop that I'm hosting. If you've been feeling angry, rageful, or burnt out, resentful, or maybe just been feeling that you haven't been heard, seen, or understood, this is a place for you. We are going to go over the different kinds of emotions that we go through when we are navigating through tough times, when there is so much bigness in the world, how to process and release them. And in these 90 minutes, I'm going to go over a playbook that will not only help you build unshakable resilience, but also give you the tools to reset and help you regulate your nervous system. Finally, bounce back from anything that comes your way. I know you're going to get so much value out of this 90-minute conversation. Claim your seat and grab the replay at neethabhushan.com/emotionsworkshop. That is neethabhushan, neethabhushan.com/emotionsworkshop. And I'll see you there. I honestly didn't even realize until right now that I'm like, oh, she's an MD. I did not notice that. Yeah. So And you're still a practicing physician.
Yeah. So I've been practicing for the last 25 years, primary care, integrative medicine. And then in the last 2 years, added on psychedelics. And then I'm going to leave primary care now and just do integrative and psychedelic because I can't keep doing everything.
Yes.
I mean, I was delivering babies for 20 years.
You were delivering babies as well? Oh my goodness.
Yeah. You got to like take something out.
What caused the shift?
To what?
From primary care into now really focusing on psychedelic therapy?
Well, I was always doing integrative work, and it's really psychedelics is full circle. It's all my plant medicine, spirituality, integrative work, and then social justice work all put together. And I've done a lot of trauma work around the world and really done a lot of complex mental health. So it just feels like the exact right thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So take us through your journey, because you are not like a lot of the physicians I grew up going to school with.
I know.
And I left the medical world in amicable terms, I guess, with myself. Yet there, I think, was a lot of pushback from maybe peers of mine and colleagues of mine, where now I see so many people like yourself and others who are now embracing functional medicine, holistic dentistry, and just kind of the things that I thought I was being, you know, kind of penalized for or kind of put on the side for. Yeah. Now it's coming in full force because of mental health and well-being. So take us through your journey around all of that.
Yeah. I mean, people joke, because as you probably know, being South Asian, people think that my parents were so excited that I wanted to be a physician, but they weren't really that excited because they said it was a bad business move and that I would never get married. And
oh, wow.
I wouldn't have time, right? And I really wanted to do this kind of medicine, though, where I could integrate what was the wisest medicine from around every mystical healing culture and our ancestors, and really think about medicine in a more comprehensive way. And I knew I wanted to do it to fight for health equity. And so it just felt like the right sort of blend for me. But I actually got a lot of pushback because my parents didn't really understand why I didn't want to be a specialist or, you know, be a more sort of prestigious physician. But it all worked out for what I wanted. But it was a long journey. And then within medicine, you know, it's not that easy to fight for what's on the fringe. So everyone's always questioning, you know, what's the evidence behind that? And is this real medicine? And which I think are really just leftover, honestly, leftover colonial concepts of what licensing means and what real medicine is. Mm. But so it feels like I'm always fighting a little bit on the fringe, but it is coming around. You're right. I mean, I feel like things have changed a lot.
Yeah. Do you think it's just because you're from a coastal city and on the coast, things usually start on the East Coast or West Coast, and then it starts to migrate, you know, in between? Or where do you think that has been pioneering from?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's that a consumer need, really, a patient need, that it's not working. Mm-hmm. Right? The system's broken and it's not good for managing chronic diseases and inflammatory ailments, and people don't feel better and they want something a little different and they want something that's more expansive. And so when people start asking for it, then things start changing. Also, the docs themselves are asking for it. And so when you look at the residents that we interview to bring into medicine, they're all wanting something different. They're not wanting just the conventional education path. And so all those things together really force change, I think. Mm-hmm. But I do think the coastal cities help.
Right, right. Totally, totally. Well, you've written a book called
Yes.
Joy is My Justice, Reclaim What is Yours. It is bold, it's bright, it's beautiful. Hachette, which is one of the leading premier publishers, has picked this up and published this. It is out now. And I want to dig into it. First of all, you're a practicing physician, you have three kids, and you wrote a book. So how was that journey and what prompted you to write this book right now?
Yeah. Well, this book is really a culmination of my personal and my professional work. And so, you know, when I have been fighting for health equity and social justice within medicine the entire time I've been taking care of the most marginalized communities, fighting for equity, fighting for decolonizing medical education. And so justice work is just a part of what I do. And then really people who come to me, they come to me for so many symptoms, but in the end, they're disconnected. Mm. They're lost. Mm. They have lost their meaning, their joy. And so that was a running theme always in my primary care practice.
Because you've worked for marginalized communities for years.
25, yeah.
Wow.
And then in my own life, 15 years ago, my second child was diagnosed with what's an ALS-like children disease in children. So it's degenerative and 100% fatal.
Oh, wow.
And at that moment, when I got that diagnosis, I thought, there's nothing to fight for. Mm. There's no justice. You know, what am I going to do? And how am I going to find joy? That just seems elusive, impossible as a mother. And so it really put me on this path of even deepening more what I was doing with my patients to figure out how is it possible that you can have joy when cognitively your life is not good or what you wanted.
Yeah.
And that's really where this book came from, a melding of my personal path and also all my trauma work. And this real understanding and coming to that the mental health conversation we have is broken mm-hmm. because it focuses on only happiness and confuses happiness and joy. So that's a fundamental concept in the book to bring out that happiness and joy are not the same.
Yes. Can you go into that a little bit and what makes them different?
Yeah. Happiness is binary. It's a mm-hmm. cognitive construct. It's based on what we have, what we get, what we do. It's great. I love happiness.
I'll be happy when
yes.
I graduate. I'll be happy when I get the car. I'll be happy when I get the house.
Yes.
I'll be happy when I save on my 401.
Yes. Yeah. And if the cognitive constructs of your life are not happy because you have a loss or suffering that is unchangeable, or you live in poverty and oppression, or have gone through so many traumas. I mean, I think about your life story, you know, just so many things at once, right? Then there's really no room for the binary construct of happiness sometimes, even oftentimes. And then where that leaves most of my patients, and I felt it too, is this feeling that we're broken, that we're not good enough at feeling better,
yeah.
that we're not resilient enough. And really, our mind and our nervous system and our bodies have just been doing what they are meant to do, protect us, you know, and they've done it so delicately and intricately and beautifully, but sometimes it's not serving us when it happens for too long.
Right.
Joy is completely different. It draws on the same deep well as your capacity for love and meaning and connection. It sits right next to our pain and acknowledges the truths of our life while acknowledging that maybe we hope for more.
Mm. Wow, I love that big distinction because you're absolutely right. Positive psychology and, you know, positive mindset is all about the attaining of happiness. Mm-hmm. Whereas I feel like in what you're talking about in this book, joy can be attainable even if you're going through a hard season, even if you're coming from marginalized communities that may not have much, but they're the ones that are so happy dancing on the streets and performing. And you go back home, if we go back home to India, you know, the kids that are running around in the streets, they're just having a ball of a time.
Yeah. And not only is it accessible to all of us, but it's actually, I think, critical. It's actually the boldest act of resistance we can have. Because if you think about it, every system of oppression and power thrives when we do not.
Right.
And they thrive by stripping us of our humanity, of our capacity for joy and meaning and connection and belonging. And so when we access joy, we are in our body liberating ourselves, and it's the deepest form of justice we can have. Mm. And so really what I came to understand was this path and desire for joy in my life felt very separate from my justice work. Because in my justice work, I don't know if others feel this. I know many have told me this feels resonant, that I would feel like I had to suffer. If I had joy, then I wasn't doing the fight right.
Right.
Or I would feel guilty that I was having joy. Mm-hmm. And then when the two came together, I realized my most powerful justice work happens when I am feeling that liberation in my body.
Mm. That you don't have to. That basically, because I can hear where you're working in these oppressive communities and these marginalized communities where they might not have a voice. They might be struggling and they might not be granted, you know, funding or et cetera. And of course, as a practitioner, it can actually deplete your joy and deplete the work and negate the work that you're doing. But I think what you're actually saying is those two have to go hand in hand and celebrate, you know, even the work that you are trying and the change that you're trying to create, because it all goes hand in hand.
Exactly.
Now, talk to us about how the book is structured, because I feel like there is three different parts. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a book that's so well integrated with justice work, with kind of standing for the oppressed and standing for people who don't have very much. And it's such a noble thing to write a book that joy is in the hands of everyone.
Yeah.
So take us through how you even wrote the different parts of the book.
Yeah, there's three main parts. And in the first part, we really are talking about reclaiming your space. And so making space for joy. What I hear most from my patients is, I can't find joy. I don't have room for joy. Mm. I don't have any space for it. And really what the first part is really breaking down first the fact that we're not broken, the systems are, and showing us how our systems intricately work, our nervous system, and how we communicate from our body to our brain. And really seeing how every moment of trauma or suffering has caused a moment of not feeling safe. And that these tools actually can bring back moments of safety and ease, even when the world at large doesn't feel that way for us. And so it's also about taking and untangling the stories that maybe you think you don't deserve joy, or you think that you were never supposed to have it, or you think that it's too shameful to have it. I really look at ancestral lineages in that part as well. For me, I look at stories in my own culture and my community that a mother with a dying child should be mourning and grieving and sad, or she's not a good mother. Mm-hmm. And so really having to untangle that for myself and looking at what other people's family stories might be. And then looking at what your concepts of joy are, what your ground rules might be for yourself, because really the book is about everyone finding their own path. Because I racked my brain with my editor to find a definition for joy. Mm-hmm. And I realized if I defined it, it would be using the same constraints of the system that took it away.
Yeah.
And after that part, the second part is really laying out the tools. Mm. What are these tools that we can use to touch joy and bring that back into our body and that safety and ease? And then the third part is looking at a life with a joy practice integrated. How would that be different? How would fear be different? How would resilience look to you? You know, so that's how it's structured.
Amazing. All right, loves, popping in to tell you your exclusive invite to joining me for an exclusive 3-day weekend intensive retreat experience with the one and only Sri Sri Ravi Shankar at his Art of Living Center in the incredible oasis of Boone, North Carolina. That is my 3-day Rise Up and Fly Forward weekend intensive. Now, during this weekend intensive, I invite you to deep dive into the messy moments and the obstacles and the challenges that didn't go as planned. Because in those 3 days, we are going to navigate and acknowledge the magical moment of suck, recognizing the contributing elements of your bounce factor and how to process them, how to centralize and regulate your nervous system, as well as We will be taking you through different meditations, group discussions, journaling, one-on-one sharing. And this would be your personal retreat with me as your guide to explore and embrace the unexpected magic in the mess and find your joy through the chaos of sometimes life's heavy moments. So you'll be able to learn how to overcome your internal blocks to unlock your full potential, rewire your thought patterns and replace outdated beliefs and behaviors, increase your emotional capacity when dealing with stress, develop your own personal blueprint and framework for bouncing back from life's challenges. And whether you are experiencing a transition, dealing with a loss, or simply looking to make real life changes, you will come out of those 3 days stepping into your now what and creating your next chapter. So Brave Table fam, use this link to book your 3-day experience with me for only $350 at the Boone Center in North Carolina. That is neethabushin.com/events. And that is also linked in the show notes. And now back to the show. I love how even in the first part 1, where you're reclaiming your space and where you're talking about, you know, you're not broken. And my favorite, page 20, positivity is dangerous. And can we just go into that?
Yeah.
Because I think we've kind of been alluding to it.
You probably get to this in your coaching all the time, I'm guessing.
Well, yes, because I also was toxically positive. You know, and that was one of my coping mechanisms, I think, when I was going through some of my deep, dark days in my trauma, in my grief. Yeah. You know, I was told I was the warrior in our cultural, you know, construct, our, you know, upbringing, happiness. What do you mean you're not happy? Like, go study, or, you know, and that was like the only emotion that was valid. There was no room for other emotions. And so it wasn't safe to feel sad or to let out emotions other than happiness. So how do you speak about it in your book?
Yeah. So that's such a resonant story for me. Thanks for sharing that, because it feels like a lot of what I experienced. Mm-hmm. I talk about it as this harmful thing. If we are telling people to be happy all the time, or just be grateful, or just, you know, push through, then what we're doing is dismissing what they're feeling. But there's actually neuroscience that I show that when you dismiss your feelings, you incite your threat center more. It actually looks like threat in your body because you're not being seen. And that gets you into your threat fear center and out of your ability to have clarity and motivation for change. So it's almost this catch-22 of how can you actually work to feel better when you're in your threat center, right? And what you're saying reminds me of, I talk about in the book, how my parents for a long time around my son's diagnosis wouldn't ask me how I was doing. Mm. They would just sort of let it be, right? But they were there for me. They're cooking, they're, you know, supporting me, they're loving me in their best ways. But they would ask my husband when I wasn't there, you know, and they would ask him how I was doing. So I finally said, you know, we need to talk about this. This doesn't feel good to me. And they said, well, when you're feeling good, we don't want to mess it up. And if you're feeling sad, we don't want to make it worse. And I thought, oh, that's so poignant, right? Mm-hmm. That they just think that if they don't see it, that we'll just be better. And I told them, I'm thinking about it 24/7. When you don't see it, then I feel invisible.
Yeah.
And so that's the way that I think, you know, I've had a lot of things said to me in the years around my son, and they all come from good meaning, mm-hmm. good love, but they're hard. They're isolating, especially the I can't imagine. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard that. And it mm-hmm. comes from love. It means I don't want to act like I know what you're feeling.
Right.
But I sort of urge people in the book to build bridges of imagination. That's justice work. Because mm-hmm. if you can imagine, you may not know my pain, you can't step into each other's pain. But if you can say, I want to imagine and be here with you, then you're stepping into my pain and you'll see your own pain more clearly.
And it builds that bridge of the compassion, of the empathy. And, you know, people always ask, we have a couple of different coach training companies, they ask, how do you build that empathy? And it's literally just being present.
Yes.
And I love that you're just sharing a tool on, actually, you can imagine. go there and imagine what that could look like, because movies are created so that we can build that empathy of the girl who's going through the breakup or she's going through the loss.
Yes.
And of course, it's going to evoke and elicit that emotional response in us. So I love that you're giving people the tool to actually say, wow, I can imagine. I may not know it fully,
yes,
but I can sit with you in this pain. And I think that even I love how it's structured in the book, because it is giving people not only the science behind it, and because of course that's kind of where my mind works as well, but we need to know what is actually going on in our bodies,
right,
to actually make that change. You know, sometimes people need to like feel it and maybe hear it from a friend. We all kind of take knowledge differently, but I love how you're giving people the differences in the ways that they can kind of integrate it in themselves.
And I didn't realize, you know, this is after my second child's birth, I had some very significant postpartum depression that I hid because it felt shameful.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about how I was actually doing some of this work around emotional awareness, and I realized people around me who were doing in small groups doing this work with me said, once I realized how actually in pain I was being able to voice that, they said, oh, it feels so much better to be around you.
Mm.
It felt like you had a forced smile.
Oh, wow.
And I thought that was really powerful. It hurt at the time, but sure, it never left me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now I realize with looking at the science that I have in there is that actually when we suppress our own emotions, we not only incite ours, we raise other people's blood pressure and pulse.
Mm.
We incite their nervous systems.
When we're suppressing our own emotions.
And when I saw that science, I thought, oh, that's what was happening.
Mm.
And I was making other people uncomfortable, ironically, by me trying to be comfortable instead of trying to face my pain.
And just actually accept it.
Yes.
Oh. Wow. I mean, this is brilliant and it's fascinating. And how much of your kids' journey and your personal family life, and I think the answer that everybody is waiting for is, how's your son doing today?
Mm.
And how much of that are you talking about in the book?
Yeah, I talk about it very openly in the book, and I weave those threads together with threads of my patients and my trauma groups, and really showing how not only my family, but how all of these people's human capacity for power and joy, it's inspiring, right?
Mm-hmm.
My son is declining rapidly, and we're really in a very difficult phase of the disease. And so it's hard every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. And it's hard for my two other children.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that's really important for us all to talk about too, when it's hard.
Yeah.
So sometimes people will just say, how are you? How is it going? And I'm just really honest, because I found that if I say I'm fine when I'm not,
right,
I just feel worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't always have time to really tell people how I'm doing.
Sure. I mean, it's a lot.
Right. But I might just say, it's really hard right now. It's a real challenge, but thank you for asking.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's a challenge, but I'm doing well with it right now, you know? And my son's life has really taught me so much. It's taught me how to sit with deep, deep pain, mothering pain I never wanted, but pain that actually has taught me that the dreams I had for him that were completely shattered have now been built into bigger ones than I ever imagined.
Right.
You know, and people say that stuff and you kind of think like, okay, great. But it's true.
It's true. You have this book out.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, the way that my children have pain around it, it's really hard. It's hard to watch. But it's also taught me what all parents need to learn, and I'm glad I need to learn, is that their pain is not mine to fix.
Right.
It is not mine. And so all I can do is sit with them and tell them that sounds really hard. And I'm here. You know, my daughter just told me the other day through tears, she said, I don't know how you do it. Because she was having a really hard moment. And I was just really honest with her while I cried too. And I said, I don't know. You just walk each day. I get up again and I figure it out. But I'm here with you.
Wow. Wow. I think that you know, if there is a script or a way, an essence of being as a mother that's actively going through this long-winded diagnosis with her child. And what are the ages of your kids?
They're now 20, 18, and 15.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Wow. And to give permission to parents and other people who may have young ones that they have to break news to or even have these open conversations, I feel like this book is that stepping stone because you're truly living it. You yeah. are breathing it. This has been your journey for the last 25 years. Yeah. What is the hope for Joy is My Justice?
Yeah. My hope is that really I want to disrupt this mental health conversation. I want to make it more whole and inclusive. And I want all of us to know that we have a place in it. Mm-hmm. That just because what we're going through feels so hard and so horrible, that doesn't mean that we also can't touch moments of love, hope, and peace in our body, and even more than moments. Mm. That once we flow in that river, we actually can learn how to live life even more fully. You know, I think I was a lot happier before my son Zubin was diagnosed, but I was never as joyful. Mm. And now I understand the difference. Right. And I just read, I didn't know this when I wrote the book, but J.D. Salinger, who wrote Catcher in the Rye, mm-hmm. said that happiness is a solid, but joy is a liquid. Mm. And I really want to take that in. Happiness is fixed and it's great and beautiful, but it's too solid to be the only answer. And joy is this river we can flow in and out of, and find our power in. And so I really hope that people who are feeling oppressed, feeling from suffering or the systems of oppression, that we understand and see that our power is in our joy, that we can find that, all of us.
Mm. And just, it's so, so beautiful. And I always get inspired by just, you know, when we got connected, I was started to follow you and I'm like, oh my gosh, she's got 3 kids and she wrote this book. And then I realized you're still practicing as a physician. And what are some of those moments in your life now that you are kind of sharing and taking, what's your joy practice with your family and for yourself?
Mm. One of my biggest ones is dance, mm-hmm. and it always has been. And specifically, I mean, it could be any dancing, but I really love Bhangra Bollywood.
Yes.
And so just last year, I turned 50. And
congrats.
Thank you. And at my birthday party, we had a big party, and I didn't leave the dance floor for 4 hours because all I wanted to do was dance to the rhythms that I feel most at home in. But the thing that gave me the most joy was dancing with my 3 children the entire night. They did not leave that dance floor. And, you know, my son's in a power chair. He can barely move his hands, but he was rocking it out there. And there were so many moments that I cried on that dance floor. And I just closed my eyes and thought, put this in a joy capsule for when you need it. And so that dance and music really does it for me. It can make me cry and rejoice in the same moment. Mm. And then my other really big joy practice is food, actually. Mm. I love cooking, gardening, and eating good food. It makes me feel connected to the earth, to the communities who harvested it, to the people who cook it or eat it with me. And so those are really my biggest ones right now.
Mm. Oh, this is so good. And it gets us to, you know, part 3 of your book, where you have these kind of shorter chapters, chapters 13 through 21, where how can you reclaim your joy in different phases kind of and different arenas of your life? Can you speak into that?
Yeah.
Because I feel like this is like the joy Bible or the joy handbook.
I like that, the joy handbook. For instance, I talk about resilience and I say resilience is what the world asks of you, but how you answer it is your justice. That's how you find your justice in it. So really learning to take a pause and check in. Now we have systems that we have to work in. You know, we can't all take a rest when we need to work or, you know, stop mothering our children when they need us. But we can take a pause and see what is it that I need today to support me in my wholest self. And maybe that's I need a few minutes of breath. Maybe it's that I'm just going to say no to that interaction or getting together with that person, not because I don't want to, but because I don't need one more thing, you know, and not feeling bad about it. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a moment of self-compassion. I talk about touch too, about how if we practice self-compassion with touch, it activates even more neurochemicals. Mm-hmm. And these simple, accessible things that, you know, frankly, I have to use. When you look at the studies on women like me, mothers of chronically ill children, we have 10 years less of our lives in our DNA.
No. Wow.
When they look at our telomeres. And I believe it because it's so persistently stressful.
Yeah.
But I also have to look at all the other areas of my life where I add on stress. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just my son. Mm-hmm. I add on stress of what I have to get done or what I must do to do this the best way, you know? Yeah. And so really just untangling all of that and giving space for dance, for rest, for movement, for breath, for, you know, all these things that actually can give us moments of awe and wonder looking at beauty in this world. So I really talk about all that and try to untangle it so that it becomes more of a joy practice that we're just integrating it into our lives.
And I mean, so much more of that, please.
I know.
Because I think that, you know, when we are in this constant state of shock and stress and overwhelm and anxiety, and I'm still kind of trying to wrap my mind around the shortened telomeres that you just shared.
I know.
And just thinking even in my own life of going through that much tragedy and loss and grief in my, you know, young upbringing and feeling guilty for, you know, feeling or wanting to feel joy or wanting to feel happy because like you kind of alluded to earlier, it was like, oh, we shouldn't be happy. Mm. We just had somebody die last year. We shouldn't be doing these things, you know, he's sick in the hospital.
Yeah.
And you're just reminding me in your essence and in your being to actually, to live and to savor all the juicy that we can in our day-to-day, in the dancing, in the gardening, in the food. And how is that relationship with your son today?
Oh, it's really beautiful. I mean, he is so able to be present in ways that I'm not. But he teaches me how to do that. And he's a magnet. I mean, people love him, you know? And I think it's because he exudes joy in his body. And he's sad too. He's sad. He wants to walk again. He wants to run again. But he also finds joy in what he's in the high school musical right now. And he's so happy about it. You know, he's so happy to be rolling around on that stage and singing, you know, and dancing. And he just knows how to live what's in front of him. And I think about your story and what you're saying. And I think about how much hope, though, there is. When you look at how much you're thriving in your life and you look at how much we can change that DNA, that those telomeres get damaged, and then we can repair them.
Right.
I think about that as hope for all of us.
And that's the resiliency that you speak of on page 209.
Yes. And so, yeah, you're living that.
There's so much because even in the book, you have these pause moments. So for somebody that is perhaps going through a season, I just kind of landed on don't just accept everything. What's the hope that when they get this book, how would you like them to go through this?
I actually specifically tell people that it's really yours to enter as you wish. I would love it if people went through from beginning to end. I think it builds on, but the way the chapters are, you could open it anywhere if you're feeling resonant for something in particular. Mm-hmm. And I would go through it slowly and pause and take those pauses.
And that's where the pauses are.
Yeah. I also have exercises for people who want to do them. Sometimes people want to do those and sometimes they don't. I think you can come back to the ones that feel resonant for you and leave the ones that don't, right? And my hope is that people will look at it when they take it in as an exercise in checking in. Mm. What comes up for you while you're reading it? What gets moved in you, either difficult or of ease? Those are the magic moments, right? And mm-hmm. So really just checking in with yourself as you read it. Oh,
I mean, it's phenomenal. Choosing Joy is Your Revolution. I'm just reading kind of the back cover. Mm-hmm. And Joy is My Justice. It's a book to experience with your whole body and mind. It's brilliant, profound, and necessary, and a joy to read. From the New York Times bestseller, Reshma Menakem. I mean, it's phenomenal. And it's what we should be talking so much more about. Where I want to end is, I know you have practices of the vagus nerve, and I'm obsessed with, you know, the vagus nerve and the trauma release. Can you talk about why that is so important and why it's so, I guess, revolutionary for the medical world to kind of integrate those pieces together?
Yes. Because I think now, as you were saying, things have changed where people are talking more about the vagus nerve as a relaxation way to really bring your nervous system down and relax. And that is true. But I think what gets left out is the way the vagus nerve also helps us connect to ourselves, to others. It's actually a very potent stimulator of the neurochemical oxytocin, which makes us want to care for ourselves and others. It also has the capacity to tap it. There's more information going from the vagus nerve to the brain than from the brain to the body. Mm. And so when people say, you know, we need to think or change our thoughts, I say yes, but also step lightly into your body to see what your body has to say to your thoughts. Because actually, what we can change from down here is far more powerful when it's combined with what we do up here. And so it gives us, for instance, compassion. People think of it as this woo-woo thing, like, oh, just love yourself and, you know, it'll be okay. But what it really is doing, and we've seen this on functional MRI, is the way it stimulates the vagus nerve is it tells us you are safe. You are okay. It is okay to step out there. And it improves our motivation. It helps us make change. And I call it a bold act of justice because we give ourselves the love the world may not have given us. But it allows us to step out safely into a space where we did not feel safe before. So when you really look at these tools, they're far bigger than we're being presented them as. Mm-hmm. And I think that justice is in giving yourself all of that understanding so you can give your body what it needs. Because trauma lives in the body, we know that, but that's also where it heals. Mm.
So many amazing mic drop moments. So many amazing moments. So as we kind of get into our igniting round and wrap this up, this has been so phenomenal. Oh. Where can we get the book? And who is this book for?
Yeah. You can get it anywhere books are sold, but you could go to joyismyjustice.com and that will take you straight to my website where I have bonuses and the book links for everywhere you need to buy it from. And really, this is for anyone who's feeling lost, disconnected, not included in this mental health conversation. You're feeling broken and you think that you can't do this. That's what people say. I can't do this. I think you can. Mm.
Okay, as we get into our igniting round, you can grab one of our little prompts there. You can pick up whichever card speaks to you.
Okay. Should I read
it? Sure, yeah.
What's a memory of a time when you felt the most free? Describe it. I really did already on the dance floor. But I'll tell you another time I felt free is I was in the ocean with my children, and my son can't walk, but he can float, you know, and he can kind of move in the water. And when we're together in the water, I feel like he gets the freedom back in his body that then reflects back to me that I can access my body's freedom.
Yeah, that's powerful. What does bravery mean to you in this season of life?
It means stepping up every day into my body and doing what it needs.
And what is a joy practice that's elevating you right now?
Movement, and not just dance. So my most recent movement of choice is paddleboarding.
Oh,
it's combining the water with movement. I didn't paddleboard before, but it is changing my life.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing.
Just being out there, and I feel like I can be really in the flow of the water and lose all else.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And one word that describes the season.
Hopeful.
Wow, this conversation was absolutely incredible. It is no reason why you have not just wrote a book on Joy is My Justice, but it's been kind of your evolution for the last 25 years and the way you have integrated your professional practice and the way that you are showing up so courageously and bravely and in kind of alchemizing the pain of being a mom of your sick child, but also giving other women and mothers and people permission that they can actually access joy, even through the messy, even through the hard times, even through the chronically ill states, even through the uncertainty of the unknown. And I'm just so honored that we got to sit and spend time with you. Thank you for flying all the way out from Seattle.
Yeah.
And everyone who is watching, who's listening, get the book, Joy is My Justice. Reclaim what is yours. Get it for a friend. It's always great as it builds oxytocin when you're actually sharing this with friends and community, and share this with family members, because I think that many times we get stuck in our own ways, and this is that book for this season. And I'm so glad that you were able to write this. How can we get more connected and follow you on social and ask you even questions?
Yeah. On social everywhere, I'm Meet Seti MD. On Instagram is where I'm the most active, and I love hearing from readers and takeaways, questions, all of it. And then my website is as well, thanmeetsetimd.com, and you can find out about my practice and the book and all kinds of things. It's such an honor to be here. You have done such good work in the world, so I'm just so grateful for what you do and for having this conversation with me.
Thank you. Until next time on The Brave Table. All right. Now, folks, we have listed Dr. Thanmeet's book in the show notes. Go ahead and grab it. Grab it on Amazon. Joy is My Justice. It is literally one of those books that has so much knowledge. And honestly, and follow Dr. Thanmeet Sethi on Instagram. She has so much knowledge around just coming back to our nervous system, being able to process trauma and access joy at the same time. And you can even take the quiz, Your Path to Joy quiz, and that is also linked in the show notes. I think you are going to love it. Get it for a family member. Get it for the holidays. The holidays are coming up. This is one of these books that honestly, I think everyone needs at this time around now. And giving people the gift of joy, it can be a birthright for everyone. So if you love this episode, I've linked three other episodes that can go deeper in your healing journey to access joy. And not only that, help process trauma in your healing journey. And let's continue the conversation on The Brave Table. You can follow us at The Brave Table on IG. That is at The Brave Table on IG. Go ahead and tag me at Neetha Bhushan. Tell us in stories what you love the most about the episode. And if you haven't already written us a 5-star review, what are you waiting for? It helps so much to get in the hands of other people and bigger guests and even growing our community. As always, when you screenshot your review, go ahead and send it to support@thebravetable.com. That is support@thebravetable.com. And we will send you a free gift. Thank you so, so much for tuning in week after week. And thank you for being just a little bit more brave in your actions, in your life, and in your relationships. I will see you next time.